standing up in the front of her Victoria, reins in one hand, whip in the other. She was hatless and white-faced, and her long grey hair streamed down her back as she lashed the horse like a fury. Jouncing on the back seat of the carriage was her black mammy, Melissy, clutching a greasy side of bacon to her with one hand, while with the other and both feet she attempted to hold the boxes and bags piled all about her. One bag of dried peas had burst, and the peas strewed themselves into the street. Scarlet screamed to her, but the tumult of the crowd drowned her voice, and the carriage rocked madly by. For a moment, she couldn't understand what it all meant, and then, remembering that the commissary warehouses were down by the railroad tracks, she realized that the army had thrown them open to the people to salvage what they could before the Yankees came. She pushed her way swiftly through the crowds, past the packed, hysterical mob surging in the open space of 5 points, and hurried as fast as she could down the short block toward the depot. Through the tangle of ambulances and the clouds of dust, she could see doctors and stretcher-bearers bending, lifting, hurrying. Thank God, she'd find Dr. Meade soon. As she rounded the corner of the Atlanta Hotel and came in full view of the depot and the tracks, she halted, appalled. Lying in the pitiless sun, shoulder to shoulder, head to feet, were hundreds of wounded men, lining the tracks, the sidewalks, stretched out in endless rows under the car shed. Some lay stiff and still, but many writhed under the hot sun, moaning. Everywhere, swarms of flies hovered over the men, crawling and buzzing in their faces. Everywhere was blood, dirty bandages, groans, screamed curses of pain as stretcher-bearers lifted men. The smell of sweat, of blood, of unwashed bodies, of excrement rose up in waves of blistering heat until the fetid stench almost nauseated her. The ambulance men hurrying here and there among the prostrate forms frequently stepped on wounded men, so thickly packed were the rows, and those trodden upon stared stolidly up, waiting their turn. She shrank back, clapping her hand to her mouth, feeling that she was going to vomit. She couldn't go on. She had seen wounded men in the hospitals, wounded men on Aunt Pity's lawn after the fighting at the creek. But never anything like this. Never anything like these stinking, bleeding bodies broiling under the glaring sun. This was an inferno of pain and smell and noise and hurry. Hurry! Hurry! The Yankees are coming! The Yankees are coming! She braced her shoulders and went down among them, straining her eyes among the upright figures to distinguish Dr. Meade. But she discovered she could not look for him, for if she didn't step carefully, she would tread on some poor soldier. She raised her skirts and tried to pick her way among them toward a knot of men who were directing the stretcher-bearers. As she walked, feverish hands plucked at her skirt and voices croaked, "Lady, water! Please, lady, water! For Christ's sake, water!" Perspiration came down her face in streams as she pulled her skirts from clutching hands. If she stepped on one of these men, she'd scream and faint. She stepped over dead men, over men who lay dull-eyed with hands clutched to bellies where dried blood had glued torn uniforms to wounds, over men whose beards were stiff with blood and from whose broken jaws came sounds which must mean, "Water! Water!" If she didn't find Dr. Meade soon, she would begin screaming with hysteria. She looked toward the group of men under the car shed and cried as loudly as she could, "Dr. Meade! Is Dr. Meade there?" From the group, one man detached himself and looked toward her. It was the doctor. He was coatless, and his sleeves were rolled up to his shoulders. His shirt and trousers were as red as a butcher's, and even the end of his iron-gray beard was matted with blood. His face was the face of a man drunk with fatigue and impotent rage and burning pity. It was grey and dusty, and sweat had streaked long rivulets across his cheeks. But his voice was calm and decisive as he called to her. "Thank God you are here. I can use every pair of hands." For a moment she stared at him, bewildered, dropping her skirts in dismay. They fell over the dirty face of a wounded man who feebly tried to turn his head to escape from their smothering folds. What did the doctor mean? The dust from the ambulances came into her face with choking dryness, and the rotten smells were like a foul liquid in her nostrils. "Hurry, child, come here." She picked up her skirts and went to him as fast as she could go across the rows of bodies. She put her hand on his arm and felt that it was trembling with weariness, but there was no weakness in his face. "Oh, doctor," she cried, "you must come. Melanie is having a baby." He looked at her as if the words did not register on his mind. A man who lay upon the ground at her feet, his head pillowed on his canteen, grinned up companionably at her words. "They will do it," he said cheerfully. She didn't even look down, but shook the doctor's arm. "It's Melanie, the baby. Doctor, you must come. This was no time for delicacy, but it was hard to bring out the words with the ears of hundreds of strange men listening. "The pains are getting hard. Please, doctor." "A baby? Great God!" thundered the doctor, and his face was suddenly contorted with hate and rage. A rage not directed at her or at anyone except a world wherein such things could happen. "Are you crazy? I can't leave these men. They are dying, hundreds of them. I can't leave them for a damn baby. Get some woman to help you. Get my wife." She opened her mouth to tell him why Mrs. Meade couldn't come, and then shut it abruptly. He didn't know his own son was wounded. She wondered if he would still be here if he did know. And something told her that even if Phil were dying, he would still be standing on this spot, giving aid to the many instead of the one. "No, you must come, doctor. You know you said she'd have a hard time." Was it really she, Scarlet, standing here saying these dreadful, indelicate things at the top of her voice in this hell of heat and groans? "She'll die if you don't come." He shook off her hand roughly and spoke as though he hardly heard her, hardly knew what she said. "Die? Yes, they'll all die, all these men. No bandages, no salves, no quinine, no chloroform. Oh, God, for some morphia. Just a little morphia for the worst ones. Just a little chloroform. God damn the Yankees. God damn the Yankees." "Give 'em hell, doctor," said the man on the ground, his teeth showing in his beard. Scarlet began to shake, and her eyes burned with tears of fright. The doctor wasn't coming with her. Melanie would die, and she had wished that she would die. The doctor wasn't coming. "Name of God, doctor, please." Dr. Meade bit his lip and his jaw hardened as his face went cool again. "Child, I'll try. I can't promise you, but I'll try. When we get these men tended to. The Yankees are coming and the troops are moving out of town. I don't know what they'll do with the wounded. There aren't any trains. The Macon line has been captured. But I'll try. Run along now. Don't bother me. There's nothing much to bring in a baby. Just tie up the cord." He turned as an orderly touched his arm and began firing directions and pointing to this and that wounded man. The man at her feet looked up at Scarlet compassionately. She turned away, for the doctor had forgotten her. She picked her way rapidly through the wounded and back to Peachtree Street. The doctor wasn't coming. She would have to see it through herself, Thank God Prissy knew all about midwifery. Her head ached from the heat, and she could feel her basque soaking wet from perspiration, sticking to her. Her mind felt numb, and so did her legs. Numb as in a nightmare when she'd tried to run and couldn't move them. She thought of the long walk back to the house, and it seemed interminable. Then, "The Yankees are coming," began to beat its refrain in her mind again. Her heart began to pound, and new life came into her limbs. She hurried into the crowd at Five Points, now so thick there was no room on the narrow sidewalks, and she was forced to walk in the street. Long lines of soldiers were passing, dust-covered, sodden with weariness. There seemed thousands of them, bearded, dirty, their guns slung over their shoulders, swiftly passing at root step. Cannon rolled past, the drivers flaying the thin mules with lengths of rawhide. Commissary wagons with torn canvas covers rocked through the ruts. Cavalry raising clouds of choking dust went past endlessly. She had never seen so many soldiers together before. Retreat! Retreat! The army was moving out. The hurrying lines pushed her back onto the packed sidewalk, and she smelled the reek of cheap corn whiskey. There were women in the mob near Decatur Street. Garishly dressed women whose bright finery and painted faces gave a discordant note of holiday. Most of them were drunk, and the soldiers on whose arms they hung were drunker. She caught a fleeting glimpse of a head of red curls and saw that creature, Belle Watling. Heard her shrill, drunken laughter as she clung for support to a one-armed soldier who reeled and staggered. When she had shoved and pushed her way through the mob for a block beyond Five Points, the crowd thinned a little, and, gathering up her skirts, she began to run again. When she reached Wesley Chapel, she was breathless and dizzy and sick at her stomach. Her stays were cutting her ribs in two. She sank down on the steps of the church and buried her head in her hands until she could breathe more easily. If she could only get one deep breath way down in her abdomen. If her heart would only stop bumping and drumming and cavorting. If there were only someone in this mad place to whom she could turn. Why, she had never had to do a thing for herself in all her life. There had always been someone to do things for her, to look after her, shelter and protect her and spoil her. It was incredible that she could be in such a fix. Not a friend, not a neighbor to help her. There had always been friends, neighbors, the competent hands of willing slaves. And now, in this hour of greatest need, there was no one. It was incredible that she could be so completely alone and frightened and far from home. Home. If she were only home, Yankees or no Yankees. Home, even if Ellen was sick. She longed for the sight of Ellen's sweet face, for Mammy's strong arms around her. She rose dizzily to her feet and started walking again. When she came in sight of the house, she saw Wade swinging on the front gate. When he saw her, his face puckered and he began to cry, holding up a grubby, bruised finger. "Hurt," he sobbed. "Hurt." "Hush, hush, hush, or I'll spank you. Go out in the backyard and make mud pies and don't move from there." "Wade, hungry," he sobbed and put the hurt finger in his mouth. "I don't care. Go in the backyard and..." She looked up and saw Prissy leaning out of the upstairs window, fright and worry written on her face. But in an instant, they were wiped away in relief as she saw her mistress. Scarlet beckoned to her to come down and went into the house. How cool it was in the hall. She untied her bonnet and flung it on the table, drawing her forearm across her wet forehead. She heard the upstairs door open and a low, wailing moan, wrenched from the depths of agony, came to her ears. Prissy came down the stairs, three at a time. "Is the doctor come?" "No, he can't come."
"God, Miss Scarlet, Miss Melly bad off."
"The doctor can't come. Nobody can come.
You've got to bring the baby and I'll help you.
Prissy's mouth fell open, and her tongue wagged wordlessly. She looked at Scarlet sideways and scuffed her feet and twisted her thin body.
"Don't look so simple-minded,"
cried Scarlet, infuriated at her silly expression.
"What's the matter?"
Prissy edged back up the stairs.
"Forgot me, Scarlet."
Fright and shame were in her rolling eyes. "Well?"
"Forgot me, Scarlet. Well, he's got to have a doctor. Miss Scarlet, I don't know nothing about bringing babies. Ma wouldn't ever let me be around folks as what was having them."
All the breath went out of Scarlet's lungs in one gasp of horror before rage swept her. Prissy made a lunge past her, bent on flight, but Scarlet grabbed her.
"You black liar! What do you mean? You've been saying you knew everything about birth and babies. What's the truth? Tell me."
She shook her until the kinky head rocked drunkenly.
"I was lying, Miss Scarlet. I don't know how come I tell such a lie. I just seen one baby birthed, and Ma, she liked to wore me out for watching."
Scarlet glared at her, and Prissy shrank back, trying to pull loose. For a moment, her mind refused to accept the truth. But when realization finally came to her that Prissy knew no more about midwifery than she did, anger went over her like a flame. She had never struck a slave in all her life, but now she slapped the black cheek with all the force in her tired arm. Prissy screamed at the top of her voice, more from fright than pain, and began to dance up and down, writhing to break Scarlet's grip. As she screamed, the moaning from the second floor ceased, and a moment later Melanie's voice, weak and trembling, called,
"Scarlet, is it you? Please come. Please."
Scarlet dropped Prissy's arm, and the wench sank whimpering to the steps. For a moment Scarlet stood still, looking up, listening to the low moaning which had begun again. As she stood there, it seemed as though a yoke descended heavily upon her neck, felt as though a heavy load were harnessed to it, a load she would feel as soon as she took a step. She tried to think of all the things Mammy and Ellen had done for her when Wade was born, but the merciful blurring of the childbirth pains obscured almost everything in mist. She did recall a few things, and she spoke to Prissy rapidly, authority in her voice.
"Build a fire in the stove, and keep hot water boiling in the kettle. And bring up all the towels you can find and that ball of twine. And get me the scissors. Don't come telling me you can't find them. Get them, and get them quick. Now hurry."
She jerked Prissy to her feet and sent her kitchenwards with a shove. Then she squared her shoulders and started up the stairs. It was going to be difficult. Telling Melanie that she and Prissy were to deliver her baby. Chapter 22. There would never again be an afternoon as long as this one, or as hot, or as full of lazy, insolent flies. They swarmed on Melanie despite the fan Scarlet kept in constant motion. Her arms ached from swinging the wide palmetto leaf. All her efforts seemed futile, for while she brushed them from Melanie's moist face, they crawled on her clammy feet and legs and made her jerk them weakly and cry,
"Please, on my feet."
The room was in semi-gloom, for Scarlet had pulled down the shades to shut out the heat and brightness. Pinpoints of sunlight came in through minute holes in the shades and about the edges. The room was an oven, and Scarlet's sweat-drenched clothes never dried but became wetter and stickier as the hours went by. Prissy was crouched in a corner, sweating too, and smelled so abominably Scarlet would have sent her from the room had she not feared the girl would take to her heels if once out of sight. Melanie lay on the bed on a sheet dark with perspiration and splotched with dampness where Scarlet had spilled water. She twisted endlessly, to one side, to the other, to left, to right, and back again. Sometimes she tried to sit up and fell back and began twisting again. At first, she had tried to keep from crying out, biting her lips until they were raw, and Scarlet, whose nerves were as raw as the lips, said huskily, "Melly, for God's sake, don't try to be brave. Yell if you want to. There's nobody to hear you but us." As the afternoon wore on, Melanie moaned whether she wanted to be brave or not, and sometimes she screamed. When she did, Scarlet dropped her head into her hands and covered her ears and twisted her body and wished that she herself were dead. Anything was preferable to being a helpless witness to such pain. Anything was better than being tied here waiting for a baby that took such a long time to come. Waiting. When, for all she knew, the Yankees were actually at 5 points. She fervently wished she had paid more attention to the whispered conversations of matrons on the subject of childbirth. If only she had. If only she had been more interested in such matters, she'd know whether Melanie was taking a long time or not. She had a vague memory of one of Aunt Pity's stories of a friend who was in labor for 2 days and died without ever having the baby. Suppose Melanie should go on like this for 2 days. But Melanie was so delicate. She couldn't stand 2 days of this pain. She'd die soon if the baby didn't hurry. And how could she ever face Ashley, if he were still alive, and tell him that Melanie had died after she had promised to take care of her? At first, Melanie wanted to hold Scarlet's hand when the pain was bad, but she clamped down on it so hard she nearly broke the bones. After an hour of this, Scarlet's hands were so swollen and bruised she could hardly flex them. She knotted 2 long towels together and tied them to the foot of the bed and put the knotted end in Melanie's hands. Melanie hung on to it as though it were a lifeline, straining, pulling it taut, slackening it, tearing at it. Throughout the afternoon, her voice went on like an animal dying in a trap. Occasionally she dropped the towel and rubbed her hands feebly, and looked up at Scarlet with eyes enormous with pain. "Talk to me. Please, talk to me," she whispered. And Scarlet would gabble something until Melanie again gripped the knot and again began writhing. The dim room swam with heat and pain and droning flies, and time went by on such dragging feet Scarlet could scarcely remember the morning. She felt as if she had been in this steaming, dark, sweating place all her life. She wanted very much to scream every time Melanie did, and only by biting her lips so hard it infuriated her could she restrain herself and drive off hysteria. Once Wade came tiptoeing up the stairs and stood outside the door, wailing. "Wade, hungry!" Scarlet started to go to him, but Melanie whispered, "Don't leave me, please. I can stand it when you're here." So Scarlet sent Prissy down to warm up the breakfast hominy and feed him. For herself, she felt that she could never eat again after this afternoon. The clock on the mantel had stopped, and she had no way of telling the time. But as the heat in the room lessened and the bright pinpoints of light grew duller, she pulled the shade aside. She saw, to her surprise, that it was late afternoon, and the sun, a ball of crimson, was far down in the sky. Somehow. She had imagined it would remain broiling hot noon forever. She wondered, passionately, what was going on downtown. Had all the troops moved out yet? Had the Yankees come? Would the Confederates march away without even a fight? Then she remembered with a sick dropping in her stomach how few Confederates there were and how many men Sherman had, and how well fed they were. Sherman. The name of Satan himself did not frighten her half so much. But there was no time for thinking now, as Melanie called for water, for a cold towel on her head, to be fanned,
to have the flies brushed away from her face. When twilight came on, and Prissy, scurrying like a black wraith, lit a lamp, Melody became weaker. She began calling for Ashley, over and over, as if in a delirium until the hideous monotony gave Scarlett a fierce desire to smother her voice with a pillow. Perhaps the doctor would come after all. If he would only come quickly. Hope raising its head, she turned to Prissy and ordered her to run quickly to the Meads' house and see if he were there or Mrs. Mead. And if he's not there, ask Mrs. Mead or Cookie what to do. Beg them to come. Prissy was off with a clatter, and Scarlett watched her hurrying down the street, going faster than she had ever dreamed the worthless child could move. After a prolonged time, she was back. Alone.
"The doctor ain't been home all day. Sent word he might go off with the soldiers. Miss Scarlett? Mr. Phil's deceased."
"Dead?"
"Yes'm," said Prissy, expanding with importance. "Talbot, the coachman, told me. He was shot. Never mind that. I didn't see Miss Mead. Cookie say Miss Mead, she washing him and fixing to bury him before the Yankees gets here. Cookie say, if the pain get too bad, just you put a knife under Miss Melly's bed, and it cut the pain in two."
Scarlett wanted to slap her again for this helpful information. But Melanie opened wide, dilated eyes, and whispered,
"Dear, are the Yankees coming?"
"No," said Scarlett stoutly. "Prissy's a liar."
"Yes, I sure is,"
Prissy agreed fervently.
"They're coming,"
whispered Melanie, undeceived, and buried her face in the pillow. Her voice came out muffled.
"My poor baby. My poor baby."
And after a long interval,
"Oh, Scarlett, you mustn't stay here. You must go and take Wade."
What Melanie said was no more than Scarlett had been thinking. But hearing it put into words infuriated her, shamed her, as if her secret cowardice was written plainly in her face.
"Don't be a goose. I'm not afraid. You know I won't leave you."
"You might as well.
I'm going to die." And she began moaning again. Scarlett came down the dark stairs slowly, like an old woman, feeling her way, clinging to the banisters lest she fall. Her legs were leaden, trembling with fatigue and strain, and she shivered with cold from the clammy sweat that soaked her body. Feebly she made her way onto the front porch and sank down on the top step. She sprawled back against a pillar of the porch, and with a shaking hand unbuttoned her basque halfway down her bosom. The night was drenched in warm, soft darkness, and she lay staring into it dull as an ox. It was all over. Melanie was not dead, and the small baby boy who made noises like a young kitten was receiving his first bath at Prissy's hands. Melanie was asleep. How could she sleep after that nightmare of screaming pain and ignorant midwifery that hurt more than it helped? Why wasn't she dead? Scarlett knew that she herself would have died under such handling. But when it was over, Melanie had even whispered so weakly she had to bend over to hear,
"Thank you."
And then she had gone to sleep. How could she go to sleep? Scarlett forgot that she, too, had gone to sleep after Wade was born. She forgot everything. Her mind was a vacuum. The world was a vacuum. There had been no life before this endless day, and there would be none hereafter. Only a heavily hot night. Only the sound of her hoarse, tired breathing. Only the sweat trickling coldly from armpit to waist, from hip to knee, clammy,
sticky, chilling.
She heard her own breath pass from loud evenness to spasmodic sobbing, but her eyes were dry and burning, as though there would never be tears in them again. Slowly, laboriously, she heaved herself over and pulled her heavy skirts up to her thighs. She was warm and cold and sticky all at the same time, and the feel of the night air on her limbs was refreshing. She thought dully what Aunt Pity would say, if she could see her sprawled here on the front porch with her skirts up and her drawers showing. But she did not care. She did not care about anything. Time had stood still. It might be just after twilight, and it might be midnight. She didn't know or care. She heard sounds of moving feet upstairs and thought, "May the Lord damn Prissy," before her eyes closed and something like sleep descended upon her. Then, after an indeterminate dark interval, Prissy was beside her, chattering on in a pleased way.
"We done right good, Miss Scarlet. I specs Ma could have did no better."
From the shadows, Scarlet glared at her, too tired to rail, too tired to upbraid, too tired to enumerate Prissy's offenses, her boastful assumption of experience she didn't possess, her fright, her blundering awkwardness, her utter inefficiency when the emergency was hot, the misplacing of the scissors, the spilling of the basin of water on the bed, the dropping of the newborn baby. And now she bragged about how good she had been. And the Yankees wanted to free the Negroes. Well, the Yankees were welcome to them. She lay back against the pillar in silence, and Prissy, aware of her mood, tiptoed away into the darkness of the porch. After a long interval in which her breathing finally quieted and her mind steadied, Scarlet heard the sound of faint voices from up the road, the tramping of many feet coming from the north. Soldiers! She sat up slowly, pulling down her skirts, although she knew no one could see her in the darkness. As they came abreast the house, an indeterminate number, passing like shadows, she called to them.
"Oh, please!"
A shadow disengaged itself from the mass and came to the gate.
"Are you going? Are you leaving us?"
The shadow seemed to take off a hat, and a quiet voice came from the darkness.
"Yes, ma'am. That's what we're doing. We're the last of the men from the breastworks, about a mile north from here."
Is the army really retreating?"
"Yes, ma'am. You see, the Yankees are coming."
"The Yankees are coming." She had forgotten that. Her throat suddenly contracted, and she could say nothing more.
The shadow moved away, merged itself with the other shadows, and the feet tramped off into the darkness.
"The Yankees are coming. The Yankees are coming."
That was what the rhythm of her feet said.
That was what her suddenly bumping heart thudded out with each beat. "The Yankees are coming." "The Yankees is coming," bawled Prissy, shrinking close to her. "Oh, Miss Scarlet, they'll kill us all. They'll run their bayonets in our stomachs. Oh, hush.
It was terrifying enough to think these things without hearing them put into trembling words. Renewed fear swept her. What could she do? How could she escape? Where could she turn for help? Every friend had failed her. Suddenly, she thought of Rhett Butler, and calm dispelled her fears. Why hadn't she thought of him this morning when she had been tearing about like a chicken with his head off? She hated him, but he was strong and smart, and he wasn't afraid of the Yankees. And he was still in town. Of course, she was mad at him, and he had said unforgivable things the last time she'd seen him. But she could overlook such things at a time like this. And he had a horse and carriage, too. Oh, why hadn't she thought of him before?
He could take them all away from this doomed place, away from the Yankees, somewhere, anywhere. She turned to Prissy and spoke with feverish urgency. You know where Captain Butler lives, at the Atlanta Hotel?
Yes, but...
Well, go there, now, as quick as you can run, and tell him I want him. I want him to come quickly and bring his horse and carriage or an ambulance, if he can get one. Tell him about the baby. Tell him I want him to take us out of here. Go now. Hurry. She sat upright and gave Prissy a push to speed her feet.
God almighty, Miss Scarlet. I scared to go running round in the dark by myself. Suppose the Yankees gets me.
If you run fast, you can catch up with those soldiers, and they won't let the Yankees get you. Hurry.
I'm scared. Supposing Captain Butler ain't at the hotel.
Then ask where he is. Haven't you any gumption? If he isn't at the hotel, go to the barrooms on Decatur Street and ask for him. Go to Belle Watling's house. Hunt for him.
You fool, don't you see that if you don't hurry and find him, the Yankees will surely get us all? Miss Scarlet, Ma would wear me out with a cotton stalk. Did I go into a barroom or a hall house?
Scarlet pulled herself to her feet.
Well, I'll wear you out if you don't.
You can stand outside in the street and yell for him, can't you? Or ask somebody if he's inside. Get going. When Prissy still lingered, shuffling her feet and mouthing, Scarlet gave her another push, which nearly sent her headlong down the front steps.
You go, or I'll sell you down the river. You'll never see your mother again or anybody you know, and I'll sell you for a field hand, too. Hurry! God almighty, Miss Scarlet!
But under the determined pressure of her mistress's hand, she started down the steps. The front gate clicked, and Scarlet cried, "Run, you goose!" She heard the patter of Prissy's feet as she broke into a trot. And then the sound died away on the soft earth. Chapter 23. After Prissy had gone, Scarlet went wearily into the downstairs hall and lit a lamp. The house felt steamingly hot, as though it held in its walls all the heat of the noontide. Some of her dullness was passing now, and her stomach was clamoring for food. She remembered she had had nothing to eat since the night before except a spoonful of hominy, and picking up the lamp she went into the kitchen. The fire in the oven had died, but the room was stiflingly hot. She found half a pone of hard cornbread in the skillet and gnawed hungrily on it while she looked about for other food. There was some hominy left in the pot, and she ate it with a big cooking spoon, not waiting to put it on a plate. It needed salt badly, but she was too hungry to hunt for it. After four spoonfuls of it, the heat of the room was too much, and taking the lamp in one hand and a fragment of pone in the other, she went out into the hall. She knew she should go upstairs and sit beside Melanie. If anything went wrong, Melanie would be too weak to call. But the idea of returning to that room where she had spent so many nightmare hours was repulsive to her. Even if Melanie were dying, she couldn't go back up there. She never wanted to see that room again. She set the lamp on the candle stand by the window and returned to the front porch. It was so much cooler here, even though the night was drowned in soft warmth. She sat down on the steps in the circle of faint light thrown by the lamp and continued gnawing on the cornbread. When she had finished it, a measure of strength came back to her, and with the strength came again the pricking of fear. She could hear a humming noise far down the street, but what it portended she didn't know. She could distinguish nothing but a volume of sound that rose and fell. She strained forward, trying to hear, and soon she found her muscles aching from the tension. More than anything in the world, she yearned to hear the sound of hooves, and to see Rhett's careless, self-confident eyes laughing at her fears. Rhett would take them away somewhere. She didn't know where. She didn't care. As she sat straining her ears toward town, a faint glow appeared above the trees. It puzzled her. She watched it and saw it grow brighter. The dark sky became pink and then dull red, and suddenly, above the trees, she saw a huge tongue of flame leap high to the heavens. She jumped to her feet, her heart beginning again its sickening thudding and bumping. The Yankees had come. She knew they had come, and they were burning the town. The flames seemed to be off to the east of the center of town. They shot higher and higher and widened rapidly into a broad expanse of red before her terrified eyes. The whole block must be burning. A faint hot breeze that had sprung up bore the smell of smoke to her. She fled up the stairs to her own room and hung out the window for a better view. The sky was a hideous lurid color, and great swirls of black smoke went twisting up to hang in billowy clouds above the flames. The smell of smoke was stronger now. Her mind rushed incoherently here and there, thinking how soon the flames would spread up Peachtree Street and burn this house, how soon the Yankees would be rushing in upon her, where she would run, what she would do. All the fiends of hell seemed screaming in her ears, and her brain swirled with confusion and panic so overpowering she clung to the windowsill for support. "I must think," she told herself over and over. "I must think." But thoughts eluded her, darting in and out of her mind like frightened hummingbirds. As she stood hanging to the sill, a deafening explosion burst on her ears, louder than any cannon she had ever heard. The sky was rent with gigantic flame. Then other explosions. The earth shook, and the glass in the panes above her head shivered and came down around her. The world became an inferno of noise and flame and trembling earth as one explosion followed another in ear-splitting succession. Torrents of sparks shot to the sky and descended slowly, lazily, through blood-colored clouds of smoke. She thought she heard a feeble call from the next room, but she paid it no heed. She had no time for Melanie now. No time for anything except a fear that licked through her veins as swiftly as the flame she saw. She was a child and mad with fright, and she wanted to bury her head in her mother's lap and shut out this sight. If she were only home. Home with Mother. Through the nerve-shivering sounds, she heard another sound. That of fear-sped feet coming up the stairs three at a time. Heard a voice yelping like a lost hound. Prissy broke into the room and, flying to Scarlet, clutched her arm in a grip that seemed to pinch out pieces of flesh. "The Yankees!" cried Scarlet. "No'm! It's our gentlemen's!" yelled Prissy between breaths, digging her nails deeper into Scarlet's arm. "They's burning the foundry and army supply depots and warehouses and... For God, Miss Scarlet, they done set off them 70 freight cars of cannonballs and gunpowder, and Jesus, we's all gwine to burn up." She began yelping again shrilly and pinched Scarlet so hard she cried out in pain and fury and shook off her hand. The Yankees hadn't come yet. There was still time to get away. She rallied her frightened forces together. "If I don't get a hold of myself," she thought, "I'll be squalling like a scalded cat." And the sight of Prissy's abject terror helped steady her. She took her by the shoulders and shook her. "Shut up that racket and talk sense. The Yankees haven't come, you fool. Did you see Captain Butler? What did he say? Is he coming?" Prissy ceased her yelling, but her teeth chattered. "Yes'm. I finally found him in a bar room, like you told me. He... Never mind where you found him. Is he coming? Did you tell him to bring his horse?" "Lord, Miss Scarlet, he say our gentleman's done took his horse and carriage for ambulance." "Dear God in heaven! But he coming? What did he say?" Prissy had recovered her breath and a small measure of control.
but her eyes still rolled.
Well, like you told me, I found him in a barroom. I stood outside and yelled for him, and he come out. And directly he see me, and I starts to tell him the soldiers take off a storehouse down Decatur Street, and it flame up, and he say, come on, and he grabbed me, and we runs to 5 points, and he say, then, what now? Talk fast. And I say, you say, Captain Butler, come quick, and bring your horse and carriage. Miss Melly done had a child, and you was bustin' to get out of town. And he say, well, she studyin' about going. And I say, oh, I don't know, sir, but you is bound to go for the Yankees get here and wants him to go with you. And he laugh and say, they done took his horse.
Scarlett's heart went leaden as the last hope left her. Fool that she was! Why hadn't she thought that the retreating army would naturally take every vehicle and animal left in the city? For a moment she was too stunned to hear what Prissy was saying, but she pulled herself together to hear the rest of the story.
And then he say, tell Miss Scarlet to rest easy. I'll steal her horse out of the army kraal if there's any one left. And he say, I done stole horses before this night. Tell her I get a horse if and I get shot for it. Then he laugh again and say, cut and run home. And before I get started, kabloom! Off goes a noise, and I like to drop my tracks, and he tell me 'twant nothing but the ammunition our gentleman's blowing up so the Yankees don't get it, and he is coming. He's going to bring a horse. So he say.
She drew a long breath of relief. If there was any way of getting a horse, Rhett Butler would get one. A smart man, Rhett. She would forgive him anything if he got them out of this mess. Escape! And with Rhett, she would have no fear. Rhett would protect them. Thank God for Rhett. With safety in view, she turned practical. Wake Wade up and dress him, and pack some clothes for all of us. Put them in the small trunk, and don't tell Miss Melly we're going. Not yet. But wrap the baby in a couple of thick towels, and be sure to pack his clothes. Prissy still clung to her skirts, and hardly anything showed in her eyes except the whites. Scarlet gave her a shove and loosened her grip. Hurry! She cried, and Prissy went off like a rabbit. Scarlet knew she should go in and quiet Melanie's fears. Knew Melanie must be frightened out of her senses by the thunderous noises that continued unabated, and the glare that lightened the sky. It looked and sounded like the end of the world. But she couldn't bring herself to go back into that room just yet. She ran down the stairs with some idea of packing up Miss Pittypat's china and the little silver she had left when she refugeed to Macon. But when she reached the dining room, her hands were shaking so badly, she dropped 3 plates and shattered them. She ran out onto the porch to listen, and back again to the dining room, and dropped the silver clattering to the floor. Everything she touched, she dropped. In her hurry, she slipped on the rag rug and fell to the floor with a jolt, but leaped up so quickly she wasn't even aware of the pain. Upstairs she could hear Prissy galloping about like a wild animal, and the sound maddened her, for she was galloping just as aimlessly. For the 12th time, she ran out onto the porch, but this time she didn't go back to her futile packing. She sat down. It was just impossible to pack anything. Impossible to do anything but sit with hammering heart and wait for Rhett. It seemed hours before he came. At last, far up the road, she heard the protesting screech of unoiled axles and the slow, uncertain plodding of hooves. Why didn't he hurry? Why didn't he make the horse trot? The sounds came nearer, and she leaped to her feet and called Rhett's name. Then she saw him dimly as he climbed down from the seat of a small wagon, heard the clicking of the gate as he came toward her. He came into view, and the light of the lamp showed him plainly. His dress was as debonair as if he were going to a ball. Well-tailored white linen coat and trousers. Embroidered gray watered silk waistcoat and a hint of ruffle on his shirt bosom. His wide Panama hat was set dashingly on one side of his head, and in the belt of his trousers were thrust two ivory-handled, long-barreled dueling pistols. The pockets of his coat sagged heavily with ammunition. He came up the walk with the springy stride of a savage, and his fine head was carried like a pagan prince. The dangers of the night which had driven Scarlet into panic had affected him like an intoxicant. There was a carefully restrained ferocity in his dark face, a ruthlessness which would have frightened her had she the wits to see it. His black eyes danced, as though amused by the whole affair, as though the earth-splitting sounds and the horrid glare were merely things to frighten children. She swayed toward him as he came up the steps, her face white, her green eyes burning. "Good evening," he said, in his drawling voice, as he removed his hat with a sweeping gesture. "Fine weather we're having. I hear you're going to take a trip."
"If you make any jokes, I shall never speak to you again," she said with quivering voice.
"Don't tell me you are frightened." He pretended to be surprised and smiled in a way that made her long to push him backwards down the steep steps.
"Yes, I am. I'm frightened to death. And if you had the sense God gave a goat, you'd be frightened, too. But we haven't got time to talk. We must get out of here."
"At your service, madam. But just where were you figuring on going?" "I made the trip out here for curiosity, just to see where you were intending to go. You can't go north or east or south or west. The Yankees are all around. There's just one road out of town, which the Yankees haven't got yet, and the army is retreating by that road. And the road won't be open long. General Steve Lee's cavalry is fighting a rear guard action at Rough and Ready to hold it open long enough for the army to get away. If you follow the army down the McDonough Road, they'll take the horse away from you, and while it's not much of a horse, I did go to a lot of trouble stealing it. Just where are you going?" She stood, shaking, listening to his words, hardly hearing them. But at his question, she suddenly knew where she was going, knew that all this miserable day she had known where she was going. The only place.
"I'm going home," she said.
"Home? You mean to Tara?"
"Yes, yes, to Tara. Oh, Rhett, we must hurry."
He looked at her as if she had lost her mind. "Tara? God almighty, Scarlet. Don't you know they fought all day at Jonesboro? Fought for 10 miles up and down the road from Rough and Ready, even into the streets of Jonesboro. The Yankees may be all over Tara by now, all over the county. Nobody knows where they are, but they're in that neighborhood. You can't go home. You can't go right through the Yankee army."
"I will go home," she cried. "I will. I will."
"You little fool." And his voice was swift and rough. "You can't go that way. Even if you didn't run into the Yankees, the woods are full of stragglers and deserters from both armies. And lots of our troops are still retreating from Jonesboro. They'd take the horse away from you as quickly as the Yankees would. Your only chance is to follow the troops down the McDonough Road and pray that they won't see you in the dark. You can't go to Tara. Even if you got there, you'd probably find it burned down. I won't let you go home. It's insanity."
"I will go home," she cried. And her voice broke and rose to a scream. "I will go home. You can't stop me. I will go home. I want my mother. I'll kill you if you try to stop me. I will go home."
Tears of fright and hysteria streamed down her face as she finally gave way under the long strain. She beat on his chest with her fists and screamed again.
"I will. I will.
if I have to walk every step of the way?
Suddenly she was in his arms, her wet cheek against the starched ruffle of his shirt. Her beating hands stilled against him. His hands caressed her tumbled hair gently, soothingly, and his voice was gentle too. So gentle, so quiet, so devoid of mockery. It didn't seem Rhett Butler's voice at all, but the voice of some kind, strong stranger who smelled of brandy and tobacco and horses, comforting smells, because they reminded her of Gerald. "There, there, darling," he said softly. "Don't cry. You shall go home, my brave little girl. You shall go home. Don't cry." She felt something brush her hair and wondered vaguely through her tumult if it were his lips. He was so tender, so infinitely soothing, she longed to stay in his arms forever. With such strong arms about her, surely nothing could harm her. He fumbled in his pocket and produced a handkerchief and wiped her eyes. "Now blow your nose like a good child," he ordered, a glint of a smile in his eyes. "And tell me what to do. We must work fast." She blew her nose obediently, still trembling. But she couldn't think what to tell him to do. Seeing how her lip quivered and her eyes looked up at him helplessly, he took command. "Mrs. Wilkes has had a child. It will be dangerous to move her. Dangerous to drive her 25 miles in that rickety wagon. We'd better leave her with Mrs. Meade."
"The Meads aren't home. I can't leave her."
"Very well. Into the wagon she goes. Where is that simple-minded little wench?"
"Upstairs, packing the trunk."
"Trunk? You can't take any trunk in that wagon. It's almost too small to hold all of you, and the wheels are ready to come off with no encouragement. Call her and tell her to get the smallest feather bed in the house and put it in the wagon." Still, Scarlet could not move. He took her arm in a strong grasp, and some of the vitality which animated him seemed to flow into her body. If only she could be as cool and casual as he was! He propelled her into the hall, but she still stood helplessly looking at him. His lip went down mockingly. "Can this be the heroic young woman who assured me she feared neither God nor man?" He suddenly burst into laughter and dropped her arm. Stung, she glared at him, hating him.
"I'm not afraid," she said.
"Yes, you are. In another moment you'll be in a swoon, and I have no smelling salts about me." She stamped her foot impotently because she couldn't think of anything else to do, and without a word picked up the lamp and started up the stairs. He was close behind her, and she could hear him laughing softly to himself. That sound stiffened her spine. She went into Wade's nursery and found him sitting clutched in Prissy's arms, half-dressed, hiccuping quietly. Prissy was whimpering. The feather tick on Wade's bed was small, and she ordered Prissy to drag it down the stairs and into the wagon. Prissy put down the child and obeyed. Wade followed her down the stairs, his hiccups stilled by his interest in the proceedings. "Come," said Scarlet, turning to Melanie's door, and Rhett followed her, hat in hand. Melanie lay quietly with the sheet up to her chin. Her face was deathly white, but her eyes, sunken and black-circled, were serene. She showed no surprise at the sight of Rhett in her bedroom, but seemed to take it as a matter of course. She tried to smile weakly, but the smile died before it reached the corners of her mouth. "We're going home to Tara," Scarlet explained rapidly. "The Yankees are coming. Rhett is going to take us. It's the only way, Melly." Melanie tried to nod her head feebly and gestured toward the baby. Scarlet picked up the small baby and wrapped him hastily in a thick towel. Rhett stepped to the bed. "I'll try not to hurt you," he said quietly, tucking the sheet about her. "See if you can put your arms around my neck." Melanie tried, but they fell back weakly. He bent, slipped an arm under her shoulders, and another across her knees, and lifted her gently. She didn't cry out, but Scarlet saw her bite her lip and go even whiter. Scarlet held the lamp high for Rhett to see and started toward the door when Melanie made a feeble gesture toward the wall.
"What is it?"
Rhett asked softly.
"Please," Melanie whispered, trying to point. "Charles."
Rhett looked down at her as if he thought her delirious, but Scarlet understood and was irritated. She knew Melanie wanted the daguerreotype of Charles, which hung on the wall below his sword and pistol.
"Please," Melanie whispered again. "The sword."
"Oh, all right," said Scarlet, and after she had lighted Rhett's careful way down the steps, she went back and unhooked the sword and pistol belt. It would be awkward, carrying them as well as the baby and the lamp. That was just like Melanie. Not to be at all bothered over nearly dying and having the Yankees at her heels, but to worry about Charles's things. As she took down the daguerreotype, she caught a glimpse of Charles's face. His large brown eyes met hers, and she stopped for a moment to look at the picture curiously. This man had been her husband, had lain beside her for a few nights, had given her a child with eyes as soft and brown as his, and she could hardly remember him. The child in her arms waved small fists and mewed softly, and she looked down at him. For the first time, she realized that this was Ashley's baby, and suddenly wished with all the strength left in her that he were her baby, hers and Ashley's. Prissy came bounding up the stairs, and Scarlet handed the child to her. They went hastily down, the lamp throwing uncertain shadows on the wall. In the hall, Scarlet saw a bonnet, and put it on hurriedly, tying the ribbons under her chin. It was Melanie's black mourning bonnet, and it didn't fit Scarlet's head, but she could not recall where she had put her own bonnet. She went out of the house and down the front steps, carrying the lamp and trying to keep the saber from banging against her legs. Melanie lay full length in the back of the wagon, and beside her were Wade and the towel-swathed baby. Prissy climbed in and took the baby in her arms. The wagon was very small, and the boards about the sides very low. The wheels leaned inward as if their first revolution would make them come off. She took one look at the horse, and her heart sank. He was a small, emaciated animal, and he stood with his head dispiritedly low, almost between his forelegs. His back was raw with sores and harness galls, and he breathed as no sound horse should.
"Not much of an animal, is it?"
grinned Rhett.
"Looks like he'll die in the shafts. But he's the best I could do. Some day I'll tell you with embellishments just where and how I stole him, and how narrowly I missed getting shot. Nothing but my devotion to you would make me, at this stage of my career, turn horse thief, and thief of such a horse. Let me help you in."
He took the lamp from her and set it on the ground. The front seat was only a narrow plank across the sides of the wagon. Rhett picked Scarlet up bodily and swung her to it. How wonderful to be a man and as strong as Rhett, she thought, tucking her wide skirts about her. With Rhett beside her, she didn't fear anything. Neither the fire, nor the noise, nor the Yankees. He climbed onto the seat beside her and picked up the reins.
"Oh, wait!" she cried. "I forgot to lock the front door."
He burst into a roar of laughter and flapped the reins upon the horse's back.
"What are you laughing at?"
"At you. Locking the Yankees out," he said.
And the horse started off slowly, reluctantly. The lamp on the sidewalk burned on, making a tiny yellow circle of light which grew smaller and smaller as they moved away. Rhett turned the horse's slow feet westward from Peachtree, and the wobbling wagon jounced into the rutty lane with a violence that wrenched an abruptly stifled moan from Melanie. Dark trees interlaced above their heads. Dark, silent houses loomed on either side, and the white palings of fences gleamed faintly, like a row of tombstones. The narrow street was a dim tunnel, but faintly through the thick leafy ceiling the hideous red glow of the sky penetrated, and shadows chased one another down the dark way like mad ghosts. The smell of smoke came stronger and stronger, and on the wings of the hot breeze came a pandemonium of sound from the center of town, yells, the dull rumbling of heavy army wagons, and the steady tramp of marching feet. As Rhett jerked the horse's head and turned him into another street, another deafening explosion tore the air, and a monstrous skyrocket of flame and smoke shot up in the west.
"That must be the last of the ammunition trains," Rhett said calmly. "Why didn't they get them out this morning, the fools? There was plenty of time." "Well, too bad for us. I thought by circling around the center of town we might avoid the fire and that drunken mob on Decatur Street and get through to the southwest part of town without any danger. But we've got to cross Marietta Street somewhere, and that explosion was near Marietta Street, or I miss my guess."
Must we go through the fire?" Scarlet quavered.
"Not if we hurry," said Rhett, and springing from the wagon, he disappeared into the darkness of a yard.
When he returned, he had a small limb of a tree in his hand, and he laid it mercilessly across the horse's galled back. The animal broke into a shambling trot, his breath panting and labored, and the wagon swayed forward with a jolt that threw them about like popcorn in a popper. The baby wailed, and Prissy and Wade cried out as they bruised themselves against the sides of the wagon. But from Melanie there was no sound. As they neared Marietta Street, the trees thinned out, and the tall flames roaring up above the buildings threw street and houses into a glare of light brighter than day, casting monstrous shadows that twisted as wildly as torn sails flapping in a gale on a sinking ship. Scarlet's teeth chattered, but so great was her terror she was not even aware of it. She was cold and she shivered, even though the heat of the flames was already hot against their faces. This was hell, and she was in it. And if she could only have conquered her shaking knees, she would have leaped from the wagon and run screaming back the dark road they had come, back to the refuge of Miss Pittypat's house. She shrank closer to Rhett, took his arm in fingers that trembled, and looked up at him for words, for comfort, for something reassuring. In the unholy crimson glow that bathed them, his dark profile stood out as clearly as the head on an ancient coin, beautiful, cruel, and decadent. At her touch he turned to her, his eyes gleaming with a light as frightening as the fire. To Scarlet, he seemed as exhilarated and contemptuous as if he got strong pleasure from the situation, as if he welcomed the inferno they were approaching. "Here," he said, laying a hand on one of the long-barreled pistols in his belt. "If anyone, black or white, comes up on your side of the wagon and tries to lay hand on the horse, shoot him, and we'll ask questions later. But for God's sake, don't shoot the nag in your excitement." I have a pistol," she whispered, clutching the weapon in her lap, perfectly certain that if death stared her in the face, she would be too frightened to pull the trigger.
"You have? Where did you get it?"
"It's Charles's."
"Charles?"
"Yes, Charles. My husband."
"Did you ever really have a husband, my dear?"
he whispered and laughed softly. "If he would only be serious. If he would only hurry."
How do you suppose I got my boy? She cried fiercely.
Oh, there are other ways than husbands.
Will you hush and hurry? But he drew rein abruptly, almost at Marietta Street, in the shadow of a warehouse not yet touched by the flames. Hurry!
It was the only word in her mind. Hurry! Hurry! Soldiers, he said. The detachment came down Marietta Street, between the burning buildings, walking at root step, tiredly, rifles held anyway, heads down, too weary to hurry. Too weary to care if timbers were crashing to right and left, and smoke billowing about them. They were all ragged, so ragged that between officers and men there was no distinguishing insignia except here and there, a torn hat brim pinned up with a wreathed C.S.A. Many were barefooted, and here and there a dirty bandage wrapped a head or arm. They went past, looking neither to left nor right, so silent that had it not been for the steady tramp of feet, they might all have been ghosts. "Take a good look at them," came Rhett's jibing voice. "So you can tell your grandchildren you saw the rear guard of the glorious cause in retreat." Suddenly, she hated him. Hated him with a strength that momentarily overpowered her fear, made it seem petty and small. She knew her safety and that of the others in the back of the wagon depended on him and him alone, but she hated him for his sneering at those ragged ranks. She thought of Charles, who was dead, and Ashley, who might be dead, and all the gay and gallant young men who were rotting in shallow graves, and she forgot that she, too, had once thought them fools. She couldn't speak, but hatred and disgust burned in her eyes as she stared at him fiercely. As the last of the soldiers were passing, a small figure in the rear rank, his rifle butt dragging the ground, wavered, stopped and stared after the others, with a dirty face so dulled by fatigue he looked like a sleepwalker. He was as small as Scarlet, so small his rifle was almost as tall as he was, and his grime-smeared face was unbearded. 16 at the most, thought Scarlet, irrelevantly. Must be one of the home guard or a runaway schoolboy. As she watched, the boy's knees buckled slowly, and he went down in the dust. Without a word, two men fell out of the last rank and walked back to him. One, a tall, spare man with a black beard that hung to his belt, silently handed his own rifle and that of the boy to the other. Then, stooping, he jerked the boy to his shoulders with an ease that looked like sleight of hand. He started off slowly after the retreating column, his shoulders bowed under the weight, while the boy, weak, infuriated like a child teased by its elders, screamed out, "Put me down, damn you! Put me down! I can't walk!" The bearded man said nothing and plodded on out of sight around the bend of the road. Rhett sat still, the reins lax in his hands, looking after them, a curious moody look on his swarthy face. Then there was a crash of falling timbers nearby, and Scarlet saw a thin tongue of flame lick up over the roof of the warehouse, in whose sheltering shadow they sat. Then pennons and battle flags of flame flared triumphantly to the sky above them. Smoke burnt her nostrils, and Wade and Prissy began coughing. The baby made soft sneezing sounds.
"Oh, name of God, Rhett, are you crazy? Hurry! Hurry!"
Rhett made no reply, but brought the tree limb down on the horse's back with a cruel force that made the animal leap forward. With all the speed the horse could summon, they jolted and bounced across Marietta Street. Ahead of them was a tunnel of fire where buildings were blazing on either side of the short, narrow street that led to the railroad tracks. They plunged into it. A glare brighter than a dozen suns dazzled their eyes. Scorching heat seared their skins, and the roaring, crackling, and crashing beat upon their ears in painful waves. For an eternity, it seemed. They were in the midst of flaming torment, and then, abruptly, they were in semi-darkness again. As they dashed down the street and bumped over the railroad tracks, Rhett applied the whip automatically. His face looked set and absent, as though he had forgotten where he was. His broad shoulders were hunched forward, and his chin jutted out as though the thoughts in his mind were not pleasant. The heat of the fire made sweat stream down his forehead and cheeks, but he didn't wipe it off. They pulled into a side street, then another, then turned and twisted from one narrow street to another until Scarlet completely lost her bearings, and the roaring of the flames died behind them. Still Rhett didn't speak. He only laid on the whip with regularity. The red glow in the sky was fading now, and the road became so dark, so frightening. Scarlet would have welcomed words, any words from him, even jeering, insulting words, words that cut. But he did not speak. Silent or not, she thanked heaven for the comfort of his presence. It was so good to have a man beside her. To lean close to him and feel the hard swell of his arm and know that he stood between her and unnameable terrors, even though he merely sat there and stared. "Oh, Rhett," she whispered, clasping his arm. "What would we ever have done without you? I'm so glad you aren't in the army." He turned his head and gave her one look, a look that made her drop his arm and shrink back. There was no mockery in his eyes now. They were naked, and there was anger and something like bewilderment in them. His lip curled down, and he turned his head away. For a long time they jounced along in a silence unbroken, except for the faint wails of the baby and sniffles from Prissy. When she was able to bear the sniffling noise no longer, Scarlet turned and pinched her viciously, causing Prissy to scream in good earnest before she relapsed into frightened silence. Finally, Rhett turned the horse at right angles, and after a while, they were on a wider, smoother road. The dim shapes of houses grew farther and farther apart, and unbroken woods loomed wall-like on either side. "We're out of town now," said Rhett briefly, drawing rein, "and on the main road to Rough and Ready. Hurry, don't stop. Let the animal breathe a bit." Then turning to her, he asked slowly, "Scarlet, are you still determined to do this crazy thing?"
"Do what?"
"Do you still want to try to get through to Terra? It's suicidal. Steve Lee's cavalry and the Yankee army are between you and Terra."
Oh, dear God! Was he going to refuse to take her home after all she'd gone through this terrible day? Oh, yes, yes. Please, Rhett, let's hurry. The horse isn't tired.
"Just a minute. You can't go down to Jonesboro on this road. You can't follow the train tracks. They've been fighting up and down there all day from Rough and Ready on south. Do you know any other roads? Small wagon roads or lanes that don't go through Rough and Ready or Jonesboro?"
"Oh, yes," cried Scarlet in relief. "If we can just get near to Rough and Ready, I know a wagon trace that winds off from the main Jonesboro road and wanders around for miles. Pa and I used to ride it. It comes out right near the McIntosh place, and that's only a mile from Terra."
"Good. Maybe you can get past Rough and Ready all right. General Steve Lee was there during the afternoon covering the retreat. Maybe the Yankees aren't there yet. Maybe you can get through there if Steve Lee's men don't pick up your horse."
I can get through?"
"Yes, you." His voice was rough.
"But Rhett, you... aren't you going to take us?"
"No.
I'm leaving you here.
She looked around wildly. At the livid sky behind them, at the dark trees on either hand hemming them in like a prison wall, at the frightened figures in the back of the wagon, and finally at him. Had she gone crazy? Was she not hearing right? He was grinning now. She could just see his white teeth in the faint light, and the old mockery was back in his eyes.
"Leaving us? Where are you going?"
"I am going, dear girl, with the army."
She sighed with relief and irritation. Why did he joke at this time of all times? Rhett in the army? After all he'd said about stupid fools who were enticed into losing their lives by a roll of drums and brave words from orators, fools who killed themselves that wise men might make money.
"Oh, I could choke you for scaring me so. Let's get on."
"I'm not joking, my dear.
And I am hurt, Scarlet, that you do not take my gallant sacrifice with better spirit. Where's your patriotism, your love for our glorious cause? Now is your chance to tell me to return with my shield or on it. But talk fast, for I want time to make a brave speech before departing for the wars." His drawling voice jibed in her ears. He was jeering at her. And somehow she knew he was jeering at himself, too. What was he talking about? Patriotism, shields, brave speeches. It wasn't possible that he meant what he was saying. It just wasn't believable that he could talk so blithely of leaving her here on this dark road with a woman who might be dying, a newborn infant, a foolish black wench, and a frightened child, leaving her to pilot them through miles of battlefields and stragglers and Yankees and fire and God knows what. Once, when she was 6 years old, she had fallen from a tree flat on her stomach. She could still recall that sickening interval before breath came back into her body. Now, as she looked at Rhett, she felt the same way she had felt then, breathless, stunned, nauseated.
"Rhett, you are joking!"
She grabbed his arm and felt her tears of fright splash down on her wrist. He raised her hand and kissed it airily.
"Selfish to the end, aren't you, my dear? Thinking only of your own precious hide and not of the gallant Confederacy. Think how our troops will be heartened by my 11th-hour appearance."
There was a malicious tenderness in his voice.
"Oh, Rhett," she wailed. "How can you do this to me? Why are you leaving me?"
"Why?" he laughed jauntily. "Because, perhaps, of the betraying sentimentality that lurks in all of us Southerners. Perhaps because I'm ashamed. Who knows?"
"Ashamed? You should die of shame. To desert us here, alone, helpless."
"Dear Scarlet, you aren't helpless. Anyone as selfish and determined as you are is never helpless. God help the Yankees if they should get you."
He stepped abruptly down from the wagon, and as she watched him, stunned with bewilderment, he came around to her side of the wagon.
"Get out," he ordered.
She stared at him. He reached up roughly, caught her under the arms, and swung her to the ground beside him. With a tight grip on her, he dragged her several paces away from the wagon. She felt the dust and gravel in her slippers hurting her feet. The still hot darkness wrapped her like a dream.
"I'm not asking you to understand or forgive. I don't give a damn whether you do either. For I shall never understand or forgive myself for this idiocy. I am annoyed at myself to find that so much quixoticism still lingers in me. But our fair Southland needs every man. Didn't our brave Governor Brown say just that? No matter. I'm off to the wars."
He laughed suddenly, a ringing free laugh that startled the echoes in the dark woods. I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not Anna more. That's a pat speech, isn't it? Certainly better than anything I can think up myself at the present moment. For I do love you, Scarlet, in spite of what I said that night on the porch last month. His drawl was caressing, and his hand slid up her bare arms, warm, strong hands. I love you, Scarlet. Because we are so much alike, renegades, both of us, dear, and selfish rascals. Neither of us cares a rap if the whole world goes to pot, so long as we are safe and comfortable. His voice went on in the darkness, and she heard words, but they made no sense to her. Her mind was tiredly trying to take in the harsh truth that he was leaving her to face the Yankees alone. Her mind said, "He's leaving me, he's leaving me," but no emotion stirred. Then his arms went around her waist and shoulders, and she felt the hard muscles of his thighs against her body and the buttons of his coat pressing into her breast. A warm tide of feeling, bewildering, frightening, swept over her, carrying out of her mind the time and place and circumstances. She felt as limp as a rag doll, warm, weak and helpless. And his supporting arms were so pleasant. "You don't want to change your mind about what I said last month? There's nothing like danger and death to give an added fillip. Be patriotic, Scarlet. Think how you would be sending a soldier to his death with beautiful memories." He was kissing her now, and his mustache tickled her mouth, kissing her with slow, hot lips that were as leisurely as though he had the whole night before him. Charles had never kissed her like this. Never had the kisses of the Tarleton and Calvert boys made her go hot and cold and shaky like this. He bent her body backward, and his lips traveled down her throat to where the cameo fastened her basque. "Sweet," he whispered. "Sweet." She saw the wagon dimly in the dark, and heard the treble piping of Wade's voice. "Mother! Wade frightened!" Into her swaying, darkened mind, cold sanity came back with a rush, and she remembered what she had forgotten for the moment, that she was frightened too, and Rhett was leaving her. Leaving her, the damned cad! And on top of it all, he had the consummate gall to stand here in the road and insult her with his infamous proposals. Rage and hate flowed into her and stiffened her spine, and with one wrench she tore herself loose from his arms. "Oh, you cad!" she cried. And her mind leaped about, trying to think of worse things to call him. Things she had heard Gerald call Mr. Lincoln, the Macintoshes, and balky mules. But the words wouldn't come. "You low-down, cowardly, nasty, stinking thing!" And because she couldn't think of anything crushing enough, she drew back her arm and slapped him across the mouth with all the force she had left. He took a step backward, his hand going to his face. "Ah," he said quietly. And for a moment they stood facing each other in the darkness. Scarlet could hear his heavy breathing, and her own breath came in gasps, as if she had been running hard. "They were right. Everybody was right. You aren't a gentleman." "My dear girl," he said, "how inadequate." She knew he was laughing, and the thought goaded her. "Go on. Go on now. I want you to hurry. I don't want to ever see you again. I hope a cannonball lands right on you. I hope it blows you to a million pieces. I—" "Never mind the rest. I follow your general idea. When I'm dead on the altar of my country, I hope your conscience hurts you." She heard him laugh as he turned away and walked back toward the wagon. She saw him stand beside it, heard him speak, and his voice was changed, courteous and respectful, as it always was when he spoke to Melanie. "Mrs. Wilkes?" Prissy's frightened voice made answer from the wagon.
"God almighty, Captain Butler, Miss Melly done fainted way back yonder."
"She's not dead? Is she breathing?"
"Yes, sir, she breathing."
"Then she's probably better off as she is. If she were conscious, I doubt she could live through all the pain. Take good care of her, Prissy. Here's a shin plaster for you. Try not to be a bigger fool than you are."
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
"Goodbye, Scarlet." She knew he had turned and was facing her, but she didn't speak. Hate choked all utterance. His feet ground on the pebbles of the road, and for a moment she saw his big shoulders looming up in the dark. Then he was gone. She could hear the sound of his feet for a while, and then they died away. She came slowly back to the wagon, her knees shaking. Why had he gone? Stepping off into the dark, into the war, into a cause that was lost, into a world that was mad? Why had he gone? Rhett, who loved the pleasures of women and liquor, the comfort of good food and soft beds, the feel of fine linen and good leather, who hated the South and jeered at the fools who fought for it. Now he had set his varnished boots upon a bitter road where hunger tramped, with tireless stride, and wounds and weariness and heartbreak ran like yelping wolves. And the end of the road was death. He need not have gone. He was safe, rich, comfortable. But he had gone, leaving her alone in a night as black as blindness.